self-improvement has always been a passion of mine.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split podcast once again. Rob Calder joined by Nick Mihai. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Dave Peters, welcome back into the chair.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Welcome back in the country as well. So, yes. Fresh off a trip to Japan, we've been seeing on the socials, the B-League champions roll back into the ticker tape parade at Basketball Victoria, or just a little bit more subdued than that?
A little bit more subdued than that. But, yep. Yes, a very fun trip, rewarding trip. Took a group of 12 boys over to Japan, played in the B-League International Under 18 tournament, and, the boys were outstanding all week, came away the eventual champions, 5-0, yep. So couldn't ask for much more.
Well, and phenomenal experience for a start. Like, it's like, I know you went on a US tour last year where you had a group of players that you obviously coached for a period of time. Similar sort of prep for this one, where I'm tipping it was almost like a thrown together team. It's like, see how we go. Like, that's not a normal team that you took over there.
Yeah. So, we call it the Vic Select team.
Yep.
Made up of, we tried to get as many country athletes and as many metro athletes together. Yep. And we chose the team across three cohorts of yearborns. So, yep. 2009, 2010, and 2008 athletes we had in that group. So not a team that usually plays together, yep. Not a team that usually trains together. We had three practices before we got over there. Yep. We stuck in two practice games as well. As you can imagine, not everyone was available for practice. Yeah, not everyone was available for those practice games. So the preparation was light, to say the least.
Yep.
But it was fun. Like, the athletes that were available bought into what we were trying to achieve, and I guess the opportunity to play internationally was a really big thing for all of them. A lot of them want to play college basketball in the future and those sorts of things, so having the exposure to play against a different style of basketball was huge. From a preparation standpoint, would love to train them for 3 months before going internationally in the future. Yep. But
what coach doesn't? Yeah. Like, let's face it, we always feel like we're underdone on prep time.
What did you? I'm just curious, just quickly. What did you prioritize in practice? Because obviously, you're walking into different styles of play. It's not the normal stuff that you would see traditionally with our Victorian cohort. So what? How did you prepare for that, knowing that it would be so many different styles and things like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know me pretty well, Nick. There was a lot of half-court offense to begin with. I love a bit of structure and a bit of shape. So we started with that just to have a base, obviously. We had a bit of an advantage. Obviously, BV took a team to this tournament last year. So being able to watch some of those games and have a bit of an understanding of what we might face was really helpful. So we knew there'd be full-court pressure every single game. So we did a lot of work on press breaks, both man and zone press breaks, and then we just did a lot of work on using smash screens, punch screens. So press break was probably number one. The second one was actually just playing through physicality. So we did a lot of work on just being able to play off 2 feet, playing with chest bumps, shoulder bumps, playing with your arms being raked away. The international style of basketball is just officiated differently. It's not better, it's not worse, it's just way more physical. And I think until you experience it, the kids were not used to it. So we tried to let the practices go from a physicality standpoint and put an emphasis on that. So that was probably the second thing that we did. And then the third thing was just us also being able to provide that physicality the opposite way. So obviously when we play here, in VJBL, Youth League, NBL 1, we're not allowed to play with the same amount of physicality on the defensive end. So us actually understanding this is now legal, it's okay to tag really, really hard and high on a roller. It's okay to actually bump a cutter completely off their line and that won't be called as a foul. And it's okay to, as I said, like when you're defending full court, you can grab, push, bump, and they don't really give any advantages to the ball handler. Like, it's all... if you can't play through that, it's going to be a turnover.
It's great preparation for kids that get selected for Worlds and things like that as well.
Oh, phenomenal.
If they're waiting for that moment and they get hit with it there, you see some players, it takes them a while to adjust to that. So it's a really cool opportunity to play through that sort of physicality as well.
Something we spoke about is it's really good preparation for any athletes that might play at an Asia World Cup. Sorry, not a World Cup, an Asia
qualifiers
Cup. Yeah, qualifiers. Stuff, yeah. Just being able to see the Japan style of play and obviously like the speed that they play with, the pace, the way they shoot the ball, it's just a totally different shot priority, I guess, to the way we play in Australia, whereas they really just want threes, 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 or they want full court transition layups because they're just so fast. So the preparation that some of our guys got for that, if any of them are lucky enough to eventually play at an Asia qualifier, was huge.
Yep. So how did you and you mentioned they shot the ball really well and regularly. Watching your games, you guys shot the ball fairly well, it felt like. There were times where it's like, I don't think we've missed a three here for like a quarter and a half. Like, yep. How did you prioritise good shots, knowing that any bad shot will be pretty much run straight down the other end for a layup? Yep. But is there anything you sort of spoke about in terms of, I don't want to say shot making, but I'll go with that for lack of a better term, as to you shot the ball really well?
Yeah, we did shoot the ball reasonably well. I think we were probably mid-30s across the tournament overall, so like not terrible, not great, but seemed like we were making enough to have them have to
always at the right
close
time.
Out. Yeah. Look, something we used across the tournament was, and I think Nick might have seen this before, a lot of us would have seen it before, we use the terms gold, silver and bronze type shots. So gold shots are free throws, shots at the rim inside the charge circle. The silver shots are open spot up threes, and bronze are basically your step back threes, your off the dribble threes, mid-rangers, floaters. So we put a really big emphasis on having gold and silver shots. So we wanted shots at the rim, we wanted to get to the rim and get ourselves to the free throw line, or we only wanted to take threes that we were spotting up on and we were wide open on. So we put an emphasis on getting feet into the paint. We knew that if we didn't move the ball well, their ability to rotate would be faster than our ability to dribble drive and play against them. So if we could get feet in the paint off one drive, we just had to keep that ball moving.
Yep.
And once we kept that ball moving, we got better throughout the tournament, I think, of just being like ready to shoot, hands ready, feet ready. And I think once we got into a bit of rhythm, got our confidence up, I think we shot it pretty well,
yep.
especially through the back end, you know, the last four games or so.
Yep.
Did where they were going to shoot the ball become more predictable? Did that help maybe as they got used to each other maybe? I don't know. Like could that play a part in it as well? Because sometimes that helps with teams too.
A little bit. Like the style of play, if anyone watches it, you'd see it's quite – like the way we played was very similar to what you would see a lot of the VJBL teams play here or a state team play here. We played out of the pinch post a lot. We played with a lot of split down and split away. And we just filled the regular, you know, corners and wings really well with our receivers. So I think we reviewed every game. We did it like a mini nationals. We reviewed every game. We did our scouts. We did our film. So as we sort of had that film to show back and we really showed where the receivers were, what the next passes were, where the extras needed to go, I think they just got really comfortable with, all right, when I penetrate, I know the corner's filled.
Yep.
So when I draw that body, I'm throwing it. And I know if there's a good closeout out in the corner, I'm throwing it to the wing. And I think they actually really bought into the gold and silver shots. Some teams love it. Some teams it doesn't work for. This team, like I would be wrong in saying we didn't take any mid-rangers in the last two games, but I'm pretty sure we would have taken under five across two games in the semi-final and grand final. And that's not because I want to control everything they do, but we knew if we took poor shots, the transition going the other way would kill us. We also knew with the players we had to just have quality hits at it every single time, which we feel like we did. Like we were really efficient and that kept us in every game and eventually allowed us to build good margins throughout most of those games.
You speak about playing against the Japanese teams, but you also played against a German team in the final in Alba Berlin. Were they different again style-wise?
Yeah, quite different. So first of all, just the makeup of that German team like was unbelievable. Not sure if the heights were put on the screen when our games were played, but I guess like the way to explain it was the bodies that we saw, so 7 feet, 6'10", 6'10", 6'9", and they were across like multiple positions, not just your fives.
Yep.
So like they rolled out like a 6'10", 3, a 6'7", 2, you know, that those sort of bodies. The point guards were about 6'3", 6'4". So all really long athletes with, I guess, future professional bodies, we would say. A good way to describe would be like a lot of our COE athletes have those body types. So they had a group of 12 of those. So that in itself was different to the Japanese teams we'd been playing the whole week, because we're not now playing against teams that probably were playing four guards and one big. We were playing against a really balanced group that had us at every position in terms of height and wingspan. From an offensive standpoint, very different, probably a little bit more traditional in terms of the way they ran their offense and their concepts, and played a little bit more the Euro/Australian style of basketball. I was lucky enough to speak to their coach a fair bit before our game. The night before, we had a cultural night and we had a bit of a chance just to chat, and he said they were really focusing on a little bit more just playing out of triggers and read and react type offenses. But in terms of what they ran and how they ran it, there was more similarities probably to the way that we play in terms of playing out of some stagger actions, playing out of some drags.
Okay.
They didn't really play out of the pinch post, but yeah, they were they didn't shoot the three the way the Japanese did. They certainly had more of an emphasis on throwing the ball inside to the post or getting to the rim.
7 footers help.
It helps. Face it.
What was their pace like? Like, different to Japan? Obviously, Japan play with a lot of pace. Were they the same? They were still similar. Let's get down the floor quick and
Not as much. No, they were a little bit more, let's walk it up and let's try and execute and beat you in the half court, and you know, do their best to remove the captain or the nail and just move the offense, the defense. Mm-hmm. And I think they had the advantage on us just with the wingspan, as I said, like the way they were able to flick that ball from side to side and just like catch and stampede and get on the rim was like difficult for us to adjust to when we'd had four games of Japanese style basketball.
Yeah, true.
And then we come into playing a team like that where we now don't have the height advantage, don't have the wingspan advantage, and we're probably playing against players that, I'm not going to say they definitely had better IQ than the Japan athletes, but a different way of looking at the game. So it was difficult. It was a big adjustment for the guys, and I think like we did a really good job of actually using our weight to play against them, if that made sense. So we leaned on them, we were physical, like up the floor, and made it tough for them to get into their offense. Like our goal was to really try and push them out of their shape, you know, try and push them out of their triggers that they were trying to get to begin offenses. And I think we had some success with that, and obviously we didn't have success at times, and they got to where they wanted to get to, and it would be a dunk or a wide open three.
As long as you have the most successes, Dave, at the end of the game, you're good.
Exactly right. Cool experience though. Like, and congrats on the win, because obviously it's always stressful coaching. Like it's regardless of when and where you do it and how you do it. But taking a group of kids that you don't have a lot of a connection with in that sort of space into a different country to play against teams from different countries, daunting experience. And the coaching on the fly is such a big part of this. And like you said, if you had 3 months to prep your team, you'd feel fairly confident going into that. But, you know, having to coach with limited prep, with personalities you don't really know, you know, what roles are they good at and playing at, I think that's a huge result. So, and a lot of fun, let's face it. Like, it's always nice coaching good kids.
It would have pushed you a lot into, because you didn't have a lot of prep time, a lot of coach feel. I think we spoke about it last time on the pod, but you would have had to rely a little bit more on the feel of the game rather than preparation in most cases as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I don't even know if I've thought about it much. I'm not sure when the last game I coached before I actually got to Japan was. Like, I think the first practice game we had was against the under-20 Navy team, and that was the first time I'd coached potentially since the previous NBL one season. So almost 18 months. So a lot of it was me just adjusting back into being in the hot seat and actually, you know, being the one making the decisions. And as you said, coaching on the fly.
It's like riding a bike, Dave.
My ATOs weren't as crisp as they usually are. And, you know, even just getting back into subbing rotations. And like you said, Rob, like a new group and a group of kids that I haven't necessarily coached before. So getting the subbing patterns correct and making sure we had the right balance of offense, defense, those sorts of things in those lineups was challenging to begin with. But, like, we found a flow, and Darcy Thornton, who coached with me, like, did an amazing job balancing the group on the bench and helping me out wherever we needed adjustments. So
when your conscience comes into it too. Like, these are all kids that have paid to go on a trip, which is an experience. Like, yes, it's basketball, but it's an experience as well. You want to get them in.
Yeah.
Like, that's the reality. And but that's no different to any of our coaches. You know, all of our kids pay to play the sport.
Yeah.
You want to get them court time. You want to get them in the game. You want to give them meaningful minutes. The hard part for you is that you're also trying to do it at a tournament that you're trying to win. like that's the challenge.
Yeah, we did as best as we could. Like, we didn't want to take them over for the experience and watch the game from the sidelines. We wanted to get them in and make sure they felt the heat of the game as much as they possibly could. And I think we did as good a job as we could with that. And I think like they're all the better for the most part.
Definitely.
But we had a really good group of kids in terms of behaviour was amazing, and I think that just translated to the court. They were really close. As I said, we had three different age groups there, bottom age 20s, and then bottom age 18s, top age 18s. So I think there was a natural group of leaders that emerged who were the older athletes to that group. So they kind of took care of the younger guys and everyone bonded from there. And I think like, we just had a really good trip. Sometimes it just works out.
Nice. Yeah. Always nice when it ends that way. So welcome back into the real world of basketball in Victoria again as we navigate the day-to-day stresses of going back into being a high-performance coach, unfortunately. It'd be nice if we could just do tournaments all the time and just, you know, travel internationally and take junior kids everywhere, but sadly not how it normally works. Yeah. Tougher gig here, sadly. Yeah. But that's all right. So what we're going to get into today is addressing the coaching stall, and that can happen on two fronts, and that can obviously happen as a coach where you kind of feel like you're just treading water as a coach. You don't really know what your direction is for your development and your progression, but also when you're coaching your team and it kind of feels like, again, you're just running in mud, like you don't see the improvement that might be happening for whatever reason, and what you can potentially try and do to move that forward again. We're going to start on the coaching side. Nick, have you ever experienced this in your coaching, like where you feel like I'm just not getting any better?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely have had moments where I felt like I've had a coach's stall, and I feel like it changed when I changed my perspective on what is the stall. I've always said like progression doesn't equal success, and I just think sometimes if you focus on the titles and whether you're going up in positions, that's not necessarily progression, but how you adjust and how you develop players, what you focus on, how you deal with situationals and things like that is a way to progress. So I think I stalled because my perception on what stalling was probably incorrect for me. So that's where I came from it. So changing your perspective, also asking advice, like, you know, if you have mentor coaches and people that you can seek advice from, that's a great way to help ease with the stall as well, because they'll give you advice and sometimes bring you back into line and into reality. Okay, you know, expectations, reality are sometimes a little bit different as well. So, there's just a couple of reasons due to the stall. Yeah.
What about you, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, now that I think about it, there's definitely a couple of teams where I think we've had a patch of a few weeks where it just felt like, geez, are we getting better here, or are we just plateauing?
Yep.
And in a perfect world, you want to be getting a few percent better every practice. So there was definitely a few things that I implemented across those seasons, and some worked, some didn't work. But as always, you know, I think one of the things I always used to try and do was like, all right, do we need to change the environment here?
Yep.
Change our routine, just try something new. You know, is it a new voice that we need, or do I need to flip the practice plan and just do something totally off script so that they're not comfortable with what we're used to coming into and doing every Tuesday and Thursday night? But yeah, definitely had a few of those throughout our period.
Obviously, we've all had responsibilities as a DOC in the past at some stage, right? Did you ever have those coaches that go, oh, there's a bit of a stall, so they just throw a new offense in?
Oh. Daily,
yeah. Like, so, right. Like, it's. How did you deal with that? Like, what advice did you give them when you noticed that? Because we saw it a fair bit as well. Like, adding extra, you know, we run this. We're really comfortable with it, but I think the players are bored, so I just threw extra ones in.
I think it's a challenge.
It's a bulk.
There's a couple of different ways to address this. Yes, we've all had those coaches, and to be honest, I've been that coach where I've sort of sat there and thought, maybe we need a new look. So I'll just throw this in here, and then I'll throw this in here, and then I'll throw this in here, and all of a sudden your playbook's gone from 3 out to about 22, and your players forget most of the stuff that's going on. The advice I would usually give to coaches in that space, and again, it was given to me as well, so I'm certainly not the the all-seeing, all-knowing person that's come up with this, is just strip stuff back. Like, everything you've got, you can get better at. And whether that be as simple as five-out structure, pass, cut through, that person ends up being the post, flex, cut off it. Nothing more complicated than that. I can guarantee you everything can be done better in that. the pass could be better. The timing to get yourself open to receive the pass could be better. The footwork on the catch could be better. The cut tempo and angle could be better. The screening angle could be better. The person cutting off that could be better. The person making the pass could be in a better stance. Like, there's so much stuff that goes in there. Adding more rarely equates to progression, mm-hmm. from what I've seen. And, you know,
it's kind of a Band-Aid on an open wound, isn't it?
Well, it kind of is. Like, yeah. I don't think there's any one perfect solution to it, but I kind of feel like every possession you have as a coach, there will be at least 5 to 6 things that go on in that possession that you could get better at. Mm-hmm. And whether that be offensive or defense, doesn't matter. There will comfortably be 5 or 6 things. Even working with some kids on the weekend, just getting them to catch the ball on their inside foot and forward pivot took me like 15 minutes. Now, there's part of it that's like, geez, come on, players. You got to kind of work this out a little quicker than this. But then it's like, well, actually, maybe I'm the problem here. Maybe I've explained this poorly. Like, what I've asked for is not what they've heard. Mm. And, like, we flip sides of the floor and all of a sudden it was instantaneously better. And it's like, well, okay, clearly the language I was using wasn't, like, if there was a left-hander on the right side of the floor, that messes with them a little bit in comparison to when they're on the other side of the floor. So I think there are always things you can get better at. And by getting better, it is simplify it. Like, make it cleaner.
And that's the same both ends of the floor, right? Like, I've also seen coaches where it's like, oh, this defense doesn't work, so we'll just zone. And we'll do this zone, and then we'll add this zone, we'll add this zone, we'll add this zone. Like, it's just, yeah, it might fix it temporarily. Doesn't help the development of the players either, you know, in the long term.
No, and it is temporary. And that's the bit. Like, yeah. I think, like, putting a coaching lens on it, the greatest learning you get as a coach is probably the first 3 weeks you're coaching, because you have so much to learn in those first 3 weeks. So you go from this, geez, I'm a bit nervous to even hold this whiteboard, to actually, I feel like I've got a pretty good grasp on this.
Sometimes you go too far with that.
Well, you can. Right? Like, it's...
Where you look back and you go, it's all right, everyone, I've got this.
Yeah, you can get into that arrogant world at times where the ego certainly takes part. But, you know, for those first 3 weeks, you are literally just scrambling to keep your head above water.
Mm.
Like, and you're starting to learn terminology, players' names, what rotations work, what doesn't work for you anymore, what's my demeanor have to look like, all that sort of stuff. That is your first 3 weeks of trying to figure that out.
Whilst communicating with parents, yeah. Which is incredibly daunting for the first time.
Trying to get kids better.
Yeah.
Well, ultimately, which is what we're actually in it for in the first place. Mm. But after that first 3 weeks, you start to get a level of comfort where it's like, okay, now I know how to stand, what to say, what I'm trying to emphasize. And that's when I think a stall can actually happen to a degree, because you almost get comfortable with where you're at and you stop searching for new information or new things you can tap into. And I think we've spoken about it before on the podcast, like that whole Dunning-Kruger thing where it's like, you know, you don't know what you don't know to a large degree, but you almost get comfortable in the fact that you're competent, not realizing that you're kind of incompetent at the same time. Like, you're just not at that level to a point where confidence will usually come before competence. I think for a lot of coaches, like they feel like they can do it until they actually have to do it. And I've been guilty of this.
Mm-hmm.
I've been handed an offense to put in at a training session, whether that be state teams or anything below. I look at it and go, yeah, I got that. And then you walk out on the court and it's like, oh, hang on, no, I don't. Like, what's supposed to happen on this reversal? I've missed that. And I remember talking to a coach about it and they said, oh, look, I can't believe you walk out with the diagrams on court when you're demoing something. I'm like, I can't believe you don't. Like, yeah. If I forget, I don't want to have to turn around to the other coach and go, hey, what's supposed to happen here? Like, then I lose all credibility as the coach. The coach loses all trait. Like,
when I used to present, like for the, as hub lead and stuff, sometimes there was quite a few actions.
Yep.
So I would just fold it in a way that when I would talk to them, I could look down at the diagram just in case, just as like a refresher. Yeah.
I think it's good. You want to be right.
Correct. You want it to be right in front of everyone.
Yeah.
Like, you
know. Yeah, credibility matters less. Getting it right matters more.
I like what you said about the stall, though. Like, we're afraid to, it's almost like sometimes coaches get to a point where they're like, I don't want to make mistakes, so I'll stay just doing this and I won't expand and have that growth mindset. Like, I think that's a really important thing. That's an important thing to reflect on. Like, you can stall by just not going in and taking a risk or not a risk, but like, you know what I mean? Like a timeout where you try something and it doesn't work. Like, you just go, no, well, I won't call timeout. We'll just run our normal sideline out of bounds, for example. That's a way to stall as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a level too, and both of you have lived this world of like club and association land acutely well. And it's, I think there's a level there where you can go from being the learner as the coach to being the teacher as the coach.
Yeah.
And they're not the same role. Like they sit in very different spaces with, okay, I'm learning the content that I'm going to put out on the court compared to now I'm actually the person that has to deliver it. And that's nervous for a lot of coaches. Like that's one of the areas that I genuinely think makes coaches a little bit flighty about, am I doing a good job or not? It's like I watched that coach over there deliver it and they were immaculate. They were particular with their terminology was this, their pacing was this, their cadence was this. Then I've walked on there and I've sounded like a little 15-year-old that's got their voice that's about to break and so I'd really like you to do this, please. And, you know, you have no substance to it. Like that's the challenge.
Yeah,
is the actual teaching of it. And I suppose, I mean, you're probably a little bit different, Dave, because your first coaching experience came where you played, teaching very similar to what you were playing in. But did you find that that was difficult getting your message across as a coach now instead of a player?
Back then when I first began, to me, it was all just easy and like common sense in terms of I just played in it, so now I'll be able to teach it. And that wasn't the case. I needed to get better from a communication standpoint. I knew the content really well. So what Nick was saying in terms of like I never had to look at a diagram for that offense because I'd done it for so long as a player. And I feel like I was able to transition pretty well into like, okay, as soon as I got the method down in terms of how I want to communicate things, I was really good at it. But now as I progress as a coach and as I go through state teams and work with different coaches – like I worked with you, Rob, as a state coach, worked with Darren Perry, and I remember going through different things and having to teach different things that I hadn't seen before, and I was exactly the same as both of you. Like, I need the diagram, or if I don't have the diagram, I need to study this for half an hour before I go on the court because I want to make sure I sound confident when I'm teaching it, and I don't want the athletes to think I've just learnt this. Even though I may have just learnt it, I want to be really confident in terms of what's the counter, how do you deal with this, and try and preempt some of the questions that they usually come up with, because I think that's when you know you're doing a really good job coaching, is you can almost guess what the first two or three questions that are going to come out of your teaching of the offense or defense and have really clear-cut answers for them, and it really puts to bed any nerves or things that they are unsure of straight away.
Yeah, because if you go, hey, I'm not sure, but I'll get back to you, you can do that once.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. You can't just keep doing that because I'll stop going to you as well. So, yeah, it's an important one. Like, you have to be able to answer those why questions as well.
Yeah, well, not fear them.
Yeah, like, and not to freak out about it, but, like, you do. Like, if you're in a coaching staff, you've got to know you do have to know what coaches are running and why they're running it.
Well, players aren't stupid. Yeah. They pick up on stuff really well, and that can be anything from your vocal language to your body language. Like, they'll know straight away. Like, if you walk into one of Dave's sessions, as an example, you'll know who's in charge. It's obvious to everyone. Like, Dave's body language gives it away straight away. It's like, that's the guy that's running this session. Like, but that is a part of it. Like, you need to be in that space where you can own your own environment. And when we talk about the stall, I think you do notice it with coaches that make that little bit of a step forward in that, okay, they look comfortable now. Like, they're in their own skin. They know their environment really well. That becomes almost their habitat, for lack of a better term. Like, you can see it. And I think they go from that survival mode, which is early on in their coaching, where everything is just overwhelming, to refinement. And they know, okay, what do I need to put in, but what can I also leave out that doesn't matter as much to me anymore that used to matter to me previously? Because let's face it, as a coach, and we've all been there, we've all been pathway coaches where we've wanted to go further, that stagnation feels really frustrating. Mm-hmm. We've either missed out on a job we thought we should have got, but we didn't. You know, our team's not progressing like we thought they should be, and they're not. Like, that stagnation feels frustrating, and we tend to take that personally, I feel like, as coaches.
We take it more personally when we start also looking at others.
Of course.
And that's a big one, right? Yeah, like, others go in and you don't, you start, it multiplies by 10 after that.
Well, we see it a lot, I think, of like, I obviously talk to a lot of coaches, and they're like, oh, I applied for this team, but I got that team, and I'm not real happy about it. And it's like, well, okay, who'd you miss out to? It's like, oh, this person over here. It's like, well, okay. Like, just because you've missed out to them doesn't mean they haven't done any work. So don't compare you to them, because that's not fair either.
Great.
Whilst you're working, they're also working. That just might be a fit thing where it's, yes, you could coach this team. You could coach this team really well. But for whatever reason, their personality or their way of teaching or their knowledge of sideline out of bounds might just be a little bit ahead, in which case they get the role. Yeah, it sucks for you at the moment, but ask for the feedback, go away and work on it, come back again and see where you're at with it. Like it happens to everyone.
And it's really difficult as well, but like when you ask for feedback, it's find people who give you feedback, not compliments. And that's really easy for me to say, right? Like I can just say, hey, just take feedback, all good. But like it's an important thing. Like, yeah, you can sit there and we can validate your ego by saying you're a great coach and you do this stuff and one day you'll do that. But you really want valuable feedback of what you can improve on and grow from as well. So find those people and listen. Don't seek validation. Seek to improve and that'll stop the stall as well.
It's funny because I remember it. I think it was actually one of the first camps Bestie was in charge of. I just happened to be there at the time. He's like, hey, have you got any feedback for me? And I think the first two or three points I gave him were positive ones. I'm like, hey, I liked how you did this. You did this really well. And he's like, mate, I don't need to hear the good stuff. Like, give me the other stuff where I can actually get better. And I was like, yeah, okay, this is how this is going to work. No worries, Bestie. Strap in. No, he was fine. But it's
same thing different. For me as well, right? Yeah. Like I did Hub Lead. I asked Dave to come down and I said, can you just watch me? And he did give me really good feedback about where I was standing. Sometimes I would turn when I was demonstrating and I had my back to players. I originally had sideline, baseline and half court. And Dave's like, you've got to pick a line that you own because you can't have your back to it. You don't want players there. So we manage it. Like that's what you're looking for. Like that feedback that makes you better as a coach, like take it on as well. Like actually be observant of it. Yeah, it's a good one.
Do either of you practice your coaching? Like one without notice, I suppose, to a degree. Like, do you practice coaching?
Yeah, I mean, in a certain way. Yeah. So I guess like I was speaking about earlier, if I am putting together an SPP plan or an NPP plan and I'm just, working out the times and what I'm going to talk about and how I'm going to refine that drill, I do just speak through a little bit of the method of how I'm going to teach things. Yeah. So when you talk about practice, like I speak through it to myself just to make sure, does that make sense? Is it clear? And then it helps me remember it. So when I get on court, it's not the first time I'm saying it.
Yeah.
That's something I do quite often.
Yep. Yeah. Do you rehearse anything, Nick, or are you kind of just like, hey, here's my plan, away we go?
No, I do. I do rehearse. Obviously, when it's coaching your team, you obviously have the coach meetings and things like that. One thing that just comes to mind is we were in Bendigo for All-State Camp. And there was an 18s group. This was when Bestie and Coops were in those positions as well. And they handed this diagram and go, hey, we're running this tomorrow. And I was in my room walking around while the TV was on because, like, you know, what else are we going to do? We're up at 8 a.m. tomorrow. So, and I was just walking around getting ready. So then I could take the court the next day and know it without using the diagram. And that did take a few hours, but it helped me prepare going, if I get called out to run these things, I need to have some sort of understanding or else these kids aren't going to pick it up either. But preparation as well. Sometimes like it sounds crazy, but like my pregame speeches and stuff, I'll run it by my mum. Yep. Like I'll just run it by my mum as someone who's like, he's been around basketball, but wouldn't understand coaching, but definitely understands people skills and things like that. So just run it by her and get her feedback on pre-games and things like that as well. And then I talk to coaches about, like I have a select few coaches that I'll call and be like, hey, would you call a timeout here and advance it and those sorts of things. This is what I would play to get a two. This is what I would run to get a three. Like, so I would prepare all that stuff in my mind as well.
Yep. I think that's valuable from a couple of different perspectives, I think, more than anything else, in that, one, you're thinking about it not in the heat of the moment where you have to deliver it. Mm. And I think that's the value because I've put together countless session plans where I thought this thing is going to be clinical. Like this is going to be so good. It goes from this to this and I see the progression there. Then you get into the weeds of it and it's like, oh, actually, this doesn't work at all. Like the flow of this session is so off from where I thought it was because either I've explained something poorly or play didn't understand something. All of a sudden we got an injury and where I thought I had four kids in lines, I've now only got two kids in lines. That's impacted there. Those sorts of things too. I think the rehearsal is just a really good way to go about it. It's like if you're demoing something for the first time, rehearse it. Film yourself doing it. Like it's, you know, we've all got phones and those sorts of things with cameras. Like film how you sound delivering this thing because it is such an important part of coaching is how does the delivery come across? And just because I understand it doesn't mean my players understand it. And there have been countless times where you make a really flippant statement that sticks in your player's head because they don't understand it. And they'll only remember that one thing that you've said because that's the one that they didn't understand. And that's really dangerous. Mm-hmm. Like you want them to understand everything. So when you look at practicing your coaching, I would always recommend film yourself if you can. If you can, mic yourself up, mic yourself up. It is the greatest feedback you'll ever get as a coach is listening to yourself back.
Do you know, horror. Sorry to interrupt, but you know what I've been doing lately, just trialing it? Like, I've been miking myself up with the camera. So I video myself with the TV next to me for the scout to have a look at, like, how my body language is, how my tone is. Am I asking, like, trying to do some self-evaluation as well? That's been really beneficial too, because, like, I've noticed, like, my tone is enthusiastic and engaging at the first 3 minutes, and then it's sort of when I get to certain clips and certain things that I'm not happy about, like my tone changes where it should be more neutral. Like, it was just interesting exercise. If you haven't tried it, it's really good for your development as well, or it has been for me so far anyway.
Yep. And it's, I mean, even that might have something to do with time. Mm. Like, of course, for the first 3 minutes, you're enthusiastic, engaged, it's fresh and it's new. Like, as you start to creep into minutes 9, 10, 11, it's like, okay, we've been doing this for a while. The players are usually looking at their watch going, hey, when's this finish? Like, we want to get on court. Yeah. Like, those sorts of things can make such a massive difference to it as well. And, you know, it's something I don't think that we really take into consideration a lot. Like, it's the miking yourself up is just the best way to honestly get better as a coach. And you'll hear back on a lot of the things that you feel like I delivered that really well in the moment. Then you listen back to it and it's like, no, I didn't. I can see where the confusion came from and it's probably on me.
And I've been the other way as well. I've gone, oh, geez, I was really angry in that timeout. And then I've heard it back and I go, oh, actually, you know, it was pretty good. Pretty level-headed. Yeah, pretty response, yeah. So it is really beneficial, isn't it? Yep. Like, it's a great way to help with the stall because, you know, you can also determine how generic your coaching is on the floor. Like, how much of it is intensity, you know, hustle, you know, got it. We need effort, fellas. We need effort. Like, those sorts of things. Like, you can monitor those things. That will definitely stall you if you're just using buzzwords and letting them figure it out.
Just junk language.
Yeah.
I think in that sort of space. And I think it is one of those things that the better you get, the less you notice improvements in your coaching. And sometimes you want someone that's got that zoomed out perspective on it that hasn't seen your coach maybe for 6 to 12 months. They come in, they go, geez, you've really improved, where it doesn't feel like you have as a coach. Dave, I'm curious on goals in particular. Does having goals as a coach impact on your development as a coach? And if positive or negative in that space?
Yeah, I think if you have high level goals and you set timelines alongside those goals, it can be a little bit negative. As we speak about a lot as coaches, like, we don't want to be just results driven. We want to be development driven and make sure we're coaching for development, you know, 90% of the time, if not 100% of the time, unless we're coaching a state team, an Australian team, you know, an Olympic team. Like, those teams need to go out and win golds. But outside of that, we want to be coaching for development the whole time. So having goals as coaches, I think it's positive. If you have certain places you want to get to, I think having the timelines beside it don't need to be there. I think you just need to work your way through different environments. And like, I know Nick and I spent a really long time in the VJBL, but I think for both of us, it worked out really well. Like, the amount of games we got under our belt, the amount of age groups we both got to coach, we got to coach some really high quality players because we were at pretty good clubs at the time. So that experience that we both have from that has really set us both up for having reasonably good coaching careers, I feel. Whereas if I was 23 or 24 years old, again, whenever I started and I said to myself, oh, I only wanted to be in the VJBL for 3 years, I know I wouldn't be the same level of coach right now that I am. So I think, yeah, it's great for me to say I want to be at this point at a certain time, but I think having the timeline beside it is a negative, and I think that's my perspective on it.
Yep.
That doesn't work for some people, but it does work for a lot. I think you know when you're ready, and that's when you'll continue to progress to the next stage. And I think usually when you are ready, people come and find you as well. That's certainly what happened to me, and probably similar with Nick. Like, we progressed at different stages, but like, it was at the right time in our careers.
It's such a good point you make. If you do a good job and you have that growth mindset, people will find you. Like, you will stand out. Like, it's, I always feel like players are your resume. So if players get better, coaches or BDMs and DOCs, they try to figure out where those players are coming from. And if they're coming from certain areas, it always tracks back. You always find those coaches. Like I don't find many that slip through the cracks. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I just don't see many of them. It was interesting you said about like timelines on your goals. Jeez, Dave, if we put a timeline on our goals when we first started, we'd be bitterly disappointed. Yep. Right? You know what I mean? Like I think that's a dangerous thing that Dave's talking about as well. Like in this amount of time, you know, I need to be here. Well, that's dangerous because there's so many uncontrolled variables. Let's say in 2020, I said, I want to be here and then COVID hits. Like what is my goals? What happens to my goals now? Yep. You know, that's a very difficult tightrope to get through. I think it's important to have goals. I'm not sure whether you need to have timelines or not. I guess there's pros and cons to it.
I'm in the con category.
Yeah.
To be honest, like I'm anti.
I'm trying to figure out a pro. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's nice to know if you're on track or not, I guess. Like if you have a goal to be a head coach of an NBL, WNBL team by the time you're 40 and you're 38 and you haven't ticked off the four goals prior to that, well, you know it's probably not happening.
But how have you measured that timeline? Well, that's where I'm getting stuck. Yeah.
And I think that's part of it too, though. Like the goals are good, but if you are going to put timelines on it, okay, what am I missing to get there by this time? That might be the only thing because it might be a good self-reflection tool, whether it's like, okay, is my communication not good enough? Is my feedback not good enough? Am I not good at diagnosing what the problem is in the first place? Am I not sort of seeing the problem areas in my coaching? That might be where you can at least track it to a degree. But I would be really hesitant because I probably fear the other way in that if people have that goal or that aspiration to, I want to be here by this stage, they're going to shortcut some stuff.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, the leapfrogging and, skipping steps and skipping that important bulk stuff that you need to do, which is repetitions, right? Like Dave just spoke about it before, like VJBL, we've all done it, right? We need those reps.
Yeah. Well, I think we spoke about it before. You don't just walk in and start benching 180 kilos straight off the bat. You build up to that over time and you can only get better at that over time. And, you know, I genuinely am, as much as it broke me at various stages. I genuinely am grateful to the VJBL for the amount of time I actually got to coach. Like there were times where I had no interest in doing it, but it's just like, no. Like these are kids that want to be there. I want to get better. I need to go and coach them. And sometimes you didn't get the team you wanted and all those sorts of things. But okay, well, what can I do then? And well, if I wanted that team, I didn't get that team, so I'm going to coach this team over here. Can I still be around that other team? Can I go and watch them train? Can I jump in as an assistant coach there potentially? Like there are other things you can do in that space. And that's, you know, I genuinely think the reps as a coach made me a better coach. And coaching when you almost weren't motivated to coach made me a better coach. And there were plenty of times where I'd walk in, and it happens, like to be perfectly honest, every now and again on a Saturday when I go in and work with the country girls in particular, like that is my volunteer time. My Saturdays are my one day off per week and I choose to go and do that because I actually like working with them. But there are some days where you get to the Saturday and it's like, oh, I just need this day off. Like it's, and you walk in there and you kind of have that mentality of, oh, I'm not doing this begrudgingly, but I'm probably not as motivated for this as I could be. You jump in, you realize, oh, actually, I really enjoy doing this. This is a lot of fun. I like working with good kids. I like being around good coaches. You have the session, you walk out of that thing and you're almost floating. Like it's just, it's one of those sessions where it's like, I could have kept my same mentality of this is not going to be great, but instead you put yourself out there, you coach, you help other people get better, you try and give feedback and some communication where you can, and you get better for it. It's, you cannot cheat the reps in coaching. Like it is such a, like I'll die on that hill. Like you cannot cheat reps as a coach.
Well, there's no shortcut to it. And like no one wants to go, you know, play, I'll coach a 9:40 game every Friday night for the whole year. But like but most of the time they weren't 9:40, right? Because they'll push back because, you know, the 6:40 game got pushed back. Because the shot clock wasn't working or whatever. And now everyone else is playing at 10 o'clock. Like, you know, but that's where the repetitions are. You've got to do that work.
Like it's, you get better. It's, you learn to find, like, life's not fair at times. Like, we all get it. And sometimes it's not fair on a Friday. You come up against the team and it's like, oh, you know, we have our four of our five starters missing. Well, that's not fair. Well, bad luck. Figure it out. Yeah. Like, it happens all the time. Like, there's not much you can do about it.
Correct.
Find a way to adapt. And in all honesty, it has been the times where I've probably taken a lesser team that I found I developed the most as a coach over the year. And because you just have to find ways. Like, it's not easy.
That's definitely where a stall can happen, right? Yeah. Like when you're so reliant on, because a lot of the these days, because we have so much basketball, there's usually two or three pretty good studs, especially at the let's talk the VC level, yep. Right? So there's always two or three, but you know you'll stop the stall if those kids one's sick and two's injured.
Yep.
And you've got to now start figuring out a way to do this when you don't have a big on the floor and all sorts of stuff. That'll stop the stall real fast.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think your timeline is almost irrelevant. Like
I'm not suggesting to injure players, by the way. Just to be clear.
I appreciate that, as does our child safety officer at Basketball Victoria. But it is one of those areas where I think your timeline's irrelevant. Like goals, fine. No problems at all. But, you know, and again, I think we've rolled it out on nearly every podcast in the comparison is the thief of joy. Don't compare your path to someone else's path. Like, and if, oh, I've stalled compared to them. Yeah, maybe. But, you know, look at the extra work they're doing. You know, they're up coaching three mornings a week that you're not getting reps in, that they are getting reps in. You know, they put themselves out there a little bit more. They've gone and volunteered at something that has put them in a position that is, you know, challenged them. I mean, what do you do for your development there, Dave? Because it would almost be easy, I think, as a high-performance coach to go, hey, feet up, I've made this. Like, I'm good where I'm at now. Like, what do you do for that?
Yeah, that's sometimes, like, it's difficult. And it's not difficult because I know everything. It's difficult because you need to find the right people you trust and the people that have time to speak to you and are invested in your development as well. And for me, it's really just it's a lot of phone calls and touching base with people who have been in the sport for a long time. Some are in the professional leagues, some are still coaching at the VJBL level. And we just talk basketball and we pick topics and we dissect it and we just like love it and it's a passion of ours. And that's where I still learn the game of basketball. There's people in the States that I still speak to and, you know, it might just be a text message on, hey, what are you doing on this? Because I'm really struggling with this coverage at the moment. Like, how do you teach it?
Yep.
And I'll just get a few dot points back. And, like, that's all development for me because that just goes in my notebook. That's learning. I'll try and implement that the next day. One thing I got from Lindsay Gaze back in the day was when you learn something one day, you teach it the next. And that's something that's, like, stuck with me all the way through is if you learn something, just teach it straight away. Test yourself on it and share it straight away. So I've been getting a lot better at that. And it also, it tests my development because I get to see myself on the court teaching something completely different, not something that I've been comfortable teaching the last 3 to 6 months. So, yeah, it's a lot of phone calls and coffee catch-ups.
Yep. And it's interesting, though, because I've heard that statement so many times before from coaches over the course, and it rings so true. Like, it is bang on. The amount of times I've seen a drill at a clinic or something on the Monday night, I've gone to try and put it in on the Tuesday and it's like, I clearly did not understand this at all because my rotations are wrong or how I've explained it is wrong. But it is such a valuable thing. It's like you don't really know your understanding of it until you're the person in charge. And I think that's just a great way to do it because, I mean, there's so much coaching content out there at the moment. Like it's you don't have to go too far to find potentially what you're after. But I think I've probably gone down the path now of I'm not looking for, not necessarily new ideas, but I'm looking for refining ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, with some of the content out there, very AI driven, and it's like, look, is this a little bit cookie cutter in what I really want? Is this going to be really valuable for me? Not so much. But actually watching someone coach, that's where I feel like I get my most development out of.
Because
it's like now I get to hear them, the detail and what they're going into. And I mean, I'm probably going down the communication side of coaching more at the moment. It's like, well, how can we be better communicated as coach? I don't care what you teach or how you teach it. Please don't teach zone in under 12s or under 14s. PSA by Nick Mihai. Yeah, it's
that would be great.
Yeah, but you know, it is genuinely a case of, well, how did they get that message across to that player in this time frame? Like, that's what I'm more interested in now, I think, as a coach when I'm looking at development. So any opportunity I have to see a coach on court, that's where I find the most development happens. And there's plenty of times where coaches that are still at the start of their pathway will send me film on something and say, hey, can you have a look at this? And it's like, actually, I really like this. Like, I've never seen this before. They've come at it with a fresh perspective. And it's like, yeah, this is pretty good. Like, it can come from anywhere at any time. You've just got to ask the right questions or put yourself in the right situation for it. So for mine, any opportunity you have to see a coach, that's where your development's going to come from.
It doesn't necessarily have to be just on a Friday night either.
Not
like
at all.
Identifying ideas is a great way to stop the stall. Like it's, you could be sitting in front of the TV watching the NBL, WNBL, and you try and reverse engineer what action's been run. Why do they run this ball action? Like is you know, Goulding's a shooter, obviously, so he's running this and maybe I can implement that action. Or even if you don't implement it, just be aware of it. Like that helps your knowledge as well, because identifying that on the floor while you're coaching and making adjustments for your players builds trust and rapport with your players as well, when you know those sorts of actions and what they're trying to get as well. So it's a good idea. Ask the opposition coach after you finish. We played against Vic Metro recently. Like I was grateful enough to have Andy Lim and Scotty Christensen on the bench there. So you better believe I'm going to be asking them about some feedback and what I can do better as well. Like it's,
you won though, didn't you, Nick?
We did. Can we put the video up? Or
No,
we can't. It was a very, very well drawn out shot. No, but it was. But like their opportunities, if you those sorts of coaches, like they coach so many different levels. Like, you know, like Scotty Christensen coaches like all these different levels, and there's many more like him as well. So if you see them down the other end, ask for feedback. Yep. Like we're a community of coaches, right? Like we're not out to get each other. We're out to help each other and support each other.
Want to watch games with people.
Yeah.
And you know, whether that be literally in person, like I know it probably would have been the COVID sort of era where there were basketball games going on internationally still, whether it be like the NBA bubble or whatever it is. The amount of times I jumped on a Zoom call with two or three other coaches, but we watched the same game at the same time and just talked through what we were seeing, happened all the time. And even now, like I'll do it watching NBL, WNBL or whatever it is. A couple of group chats I'll jump into. It's like, hey, check this out. Like I love how they're guarding this, or I love what they've done with this. Really good way of starting that conversation and just continuing, because every now and again you get a message. It's like, hey, wind this back to Phoenix playing Melbourne United at 6:11 in the third quarter. And you got to go back and you got to look at it. And it's like, yeah, okay, well, this is pretty good. I would have missed this. I wasn't watching this game unless someone had told me that this was going on. So I think own your own space in that, but branch out, I think, is a valuable part of it.
I think, like, just touching on what both of you said, like, the coaching network is such a sharing network. And I know you've said it a million times, but even at the end of last year, Jenna and I were looking for some PD, and we just contacted United, and we went down to Melbourne United, and they brought us into their coaches' meeting, their scout meeting, their team meeting. We got to watch their vitamins on the floor. We got to watch what they were doing in the weight room, and then we saw the full session on the court. And then we had a bit of a debrief with the coaches post-training. Obviously, that's not open to everyone. We were fortunate in that situation. But I know for sure when Nick and I were coaching NBL 1, we had multiple coaches come in and watch us at the NBL 1 level. I know for sure that would be the same at any club. And I know for youth league it would be the same. If you contact your youth league or NBL 1 coaches, it's very unlikely that they would say you're not allowed to come in and watch it. A 90-minute practice, assuming you've just done it the right way and, you know, got to them prior. That's something that I always used to do when I was a junior coach, you know, watched multiple of Nick Abdusevich's training sessions. I used to actually watch a lot of Nick's training sessions when I first started, because Nick started, I think, the year before me. I could name about 10 or 15 coaches practices that I used to watch, and that was probably the – for me, in terms of my growth throughout my first 5 to 10 years of coaching, that was my best way to learn.
Yep.
By far. And try to take a problem and turn it into a solution. I've said in the past that I worked with Darren Perry for a few years as with Siebel, but I started off going, hey, look, I want to hang around and watch. I'll do the clock for you if you want. And he's like, yeah, right. Okay. So I just did this. I just kept the scores for the players, which was way more heated than I thought it was going to be, by the way. But anyway.
Yep. But I mean, you both make very good points in that, I think, is that, and it's advice I give to coaches at the moment that have maybe just been fired, which does happen more at the senior level than it is anywhere else. I try and reach out to as many as I can in that sort of space and say, hey, you know, the sport hasn't forgotten about you. Please stick around this thing, even if you want some time away. But it's more of a case of, look, what are you doing next? Like, don't sit there and wallow in this thing and toys out of the cot because you haven't got what you want. What's next? Like, what are you planning on doing? Can we bring you into more BV stuff now that you've got more time? You know, can we find a way to connect you with another coach somewhere else? And some of the best advice I give to coaches is go on a study tour for you. Like, if you want to literally take out the year and say, hey, you know, I need a little bit of a break from it, no worries. Like, have a little bit of a break. But when you get itchy feet again, which you absolutely will, put together a list of five or six coaches and just reach out to them and say, hey, can I come to your session this year? And make it everything different. Don't make it all like senior men's practice or something like that. Go and watch a senior men's team. Go and watch an under 16 girls team. Go and watch a youth league women's team. Like, give yourself a little bit of something. Go and find some coaches that you really like watching coach or you think have something to give and go watch them, because there are so many good coaches out there that will willingly give up their time. Like, it's ridiculous how giving coaches are in this space, because let's face it, the vast majority of their coaches are very much volunteers. And not just volunteers, they are giving up their time, money, sanity, energy, everything in between to go and be a coach. And they will gladly help someone else that shows a little bit of interest in that world. So when you're looking at the stall in that end, go talk to them. Like, I genuinely cannot endorse that enough. Dean Vickerman allows more people into his training session than any NBL coach I've ever met in my life. I think I've been to about three sessions over the last 3 or 4 years, and every time I haven't been the only one there. There's always been someone else that's come in as well.
He's starting to tighten up a little bit though, isn't he?
Yeah.
That circle's getting a little bit more.
Well, it is finals at the moment, Nick, so I probably wouldn't blame him too much, to be fair. But it is amazing that how many coaches will give you that opportunity, because they were given that opportunity. Like you mentioned Lindsay Gaze before. How many people would have been through a Lindsay Gaze-led practice at various stages in basketball in Victoria? Worldwide, frankly.
Like, yep.
It would have been so many. So coaches are very giving in that space. So if you do want a hand connecting the dots to a few of those, reach out. Like, we'll help you out as best as we possibly can. Just coaching at basketballvictoria.com.au, and we'll get back to you with something in that sort of space. But yeah, if you are interested in that, that is just one of the best ways to get better as a coach. Find someone that can give you some genuinely honest feedback to get you better in that sort of space. I feel like we've potentially gone over time on this one, and I do apologize on that, because we were also going to talk about the team development stall, but we may save that for another time. So there might be another episode on this.
Ooh, part two, Dave.
Oh, that's dangerous. Like, it's we're starting to get up to sort of school holidays and under 18 national, so time is running out on us at this point. So we'll see how we go with it. But we do have a social split talk for the week.
Something to post on Facebook. Let's go.
It's like me on Twitter.
So this is Chris Williamson from the Modern Wisdom podcast. Anyone that doesn't listen to that can recommend. Great mind in general. A little bit of swearing in this one. So again, you know, push through that. I'm sure you'll be okay.
What's the difference between the guys who are elite and the guys that are world champions? And he said it's the world champions that are prepared to do the most boring work with the least amount of complaining. Preparedness to accept, no matter how good I get at this thing, I will always have to do boring shit. And that's not a bug, it's a feature. And not only is it a feature, it's a source of competitive advantage, because as things get more salubrious, as you raise up through the ranks, other people will have the same thought that you do, which is, I shouldn't need to do this shit anymore. So if you can continue to lean into the stuff that you did at the start, at the end, that's where the competitive advantage lies.
So again, Modern Wisdom podcast, Darren McInnes recommendation on that one, actually. It's a good listen, tons of episodes on there. What of that hits with you, Nick?
A lot of it resonates with me. It resonates a lot with the message that we're all trying to do as coaches. And, you know, the repetitiveness of the what we call the boring stuff. I think we actually have to find a new word for it, because it kind of associates with boring. I don't really want to do it, you know. But it just feels like there's no secret to it, and there's no secret to it as you go higher at your level. And the message of the boring stuff, it's really cool to look at the shiny new toy where it's sort of like, hey, we can go do this stuff and, you know, it's not as boring, it's way more entertaining, but you sacrifice the boring stuff that accounts for later on. It's just, yeah, I don't know, it feels very obvious to me. Am I wrong in saying that? Like, it's...
Well, I hope not. There's a reason we put it on the pod.
Yeah.
Like, it's, it just, you know, feels... We tried to make it as relevant as we can. What about you, Dave? Like, anything hit there?
Yeah, like, be great at the boring, something that we all know is super important. Nick's actually hit the nail on the head, I think, in terms of finding ways for athletes to do things that may be considered boring, but not allowing them to understand it's boring, because we start it in a different way. We give them variety. We put it in the middle of a drill, and it's just like a really small part of the drill, but like, we know it's a really important aspect of what they need to learn, but it's just a small part of what they're doing at that time. And shell drill is like a really good example of like, you can do shell drill. We used to do it back in the day as players, and it was boring at that time. I try to be as creative as possible. Like, let's start the ball in a different area. Let's throw a different coverage in. Let's play it in different ways. Let's score it in different ways. And I think, like, once we do that, players really enjoy what we would consider boring tasks, but they enjoy it because it's competitive and it's different, and they haven't done the same thing for the eighth consecutive week. At the same time with that, what I found is you've got to be okay with experimenting with something and it going wrong.
Yep.
And that's something I've gotten better at as we've progressed. And, you know, like just this Monday, like we started practice with STP a little bit different and it went okay for a little period. And then pretty quickly we were like, oh, the detail's really lost here. Yeah,
right.
Okay. So you have to be confident enough to be okay with that and understand, yeah, we might have lost 15 to 20 minutes here. Finding ways to get yourself back on track's important, but that's coaching. Yep. And it's more fun to players when they're doing something that they haven't done before.
Mm. Form shooting's another one.
Yep.
Right, it's boring. I'm sure that players at the highest level still do it. Obviously, they would probably have to, right? Like, we see Steph Curry shoot that full court shot at the end, but we never get to see the stuff he's done before he's about to run off into the change room.
And that's, I think, the challenge is that people hear boring and they immediately think not engaged. And it's like, actually, the best engage with boring stuff. Like, that's habits. Like, that is the habit building straight away where it's like, no, this is just what I do now. Like, this is how I get better at it. And it's, I get the need to have fun in everything and to try and gamify as much stuff as possible. Very much on board that. Like, zero issues with that whatsoever. But sometimes it's got to suck a little bit. And sometimes you need to pull yourself out of bed in the morning and go, I don't want to go and do this, but this is the session I've got in front of me and this is what I have to go and do. And I think that's valuable from a mental resilience perspective in that it's not always going to be sunshining blue skies every time you go and play. Sometimes you're going to be in a dark stadium with no lighting, creaky floorboards, and you're just not going to be feeling well and you've got to try and perform. And, well, the boring stuff is all the work I've done before now. Like, this is the fun stuff I get to do now. That's kind of my thing with it. And it's like, when you talk about elite to world class, that's a big jump, obviously. Like, there is a lot of elite basketballers. How many are genuinely world class? You know, five men, five women, roughly.
Yeah.
Well, that's not many in reality. So I think that is something, a habit, and I think form shooting is one of them. Like, you probably did the same as I did, which was lie on your bed and shoot the ball to yourself, like straight up in the air, and you just got better at it. Yeah, it didn't help my shooting, as it turns out, but... You know, that is part of the boring. Like, where can you find ways to hide it? And that, I think that's why we call them vitamins and all those sorts of things now, because it's like, yeah, you've got to do this. We're just going to hide it in something else that you don't really realize that we're doing this in the first place. That's what it looks like from a development perspective. So I think, like, it's find a way to make the boring engaging is probably something I'd take out of that as well. But that is us for this week. Nick, Dave, thank you very much for jumping in. Coaches, we will catch you all again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.